Ladies and gentlemen, this is Michael Collins Piper. Forgive me for the late entry here, but I just did, in fact, wake up from a slumber. Much needed. I haven't been feeling well the last few days. And we are here with you live tonight on this 5th of August. It's Sunday night, and we do have a very special guest here this evening, someone I am confident that many of you are very familiar with. If you're not familiar with him personally, you are familiar with the good work that he has done on behalf of this nation and on behalf of the world for so many, many years. He's still a relatively young man, but I can tell you that he has been at it. He has been at it all of his adult life, probably even going back to before I was born. You can imagine that. And I will bring him up in a minute and introduce him. We are going to be talking tonight not only about the late, great Eustace Mullins, with whom, of course, I would say all of you are certainly familiar with, but we are also going to be talking about our guest's interesting career, because he has had an interesting career and has done so much to educate so many of us, including me, about so many things that we would not otherwise know about. And there are very few people who can claim that as a real accomplishment, having educated wide numbers of people about things that they do actually need to know about. And our guest here tonight, I'm still keeping you in suspense, folks, and deliberately so. Our guest here tonight is one of those few people who can claim credit for that. We are going to be going right into the break here in a moment, and when we come back, we'll get right to work. But let me just let you know that I discovered something absolutely shocking. One of Hollywood's most famous figures, famed director Frank Capra, who was beloved by the public and beloved by his colleagues in Hollywood. According to a book I was reading this evening, ladies and gentlemen, Frank Capra was a notorious anti-Semite. They said the same thing about Howard Hawks, too. These were big men in Hollywood. They must have known what they were talking about. Folks, we're going to the break. Stay tuned.
Yeah,
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Michael Collins Piper here, live on this 5th of August. I trust that you are all subscribing to American Free Press and the Barnes Review. If you're not, you know what to do. Go to AmericanFreePress.net and BarnesReview.com. You can get all the important information you need there about your subscriptions. Well, speaking of subscriptions, folks, you know, I started getting political back when I was about 8 years old. I'm 52 years old now as of July 16th, but I started getting political when I was about 8 years old. By the time I was about 12 years old, I actually had some political views, and one of those views was that the United States had no business getting mixed up in the Middle East. But it was about the time I turned 16 years old that I got really, really political and started writing all over the country to different political organizations and asking for copies of their newspapers and publications and their book lists. And I remember there back in the late 70s, writing to an address in a faraway state, and they had some secondhand books for sale, plus a lot of reprints of out-of-print classic books, pamphlets, and other materials. One of the first genuine, original, out-of-print books that I got was an original copy of Senator Huey Long's classic, posthumously published memoir, My First Days in the White House. As some of you may know, I wrote my own book by that title a couple years ago. But more importantly, over the years, I relied upon this particular address down there in Metairie, Louisiana, to obtain some of those rare and out-of-print books that you just couldn't get anywhere else. And that book list came from the Christian Defense League and its founder and longtime director, Dr. James K. Warner. And I was just telling my longtime boss, Willis Cardo, just yesterday that I would say that alongside Willis, who has, of course, certainly published thousands of books, magazines, newspapers, and other things, I don't think there has been anyone else in the truth movement in America. And I say that. I say that with pretty good knowledge. There are very few other people who have had the influence that James K. Warner has had through his Christian Defense League and through his distribution of so many, literally hundreds of books and materials that he kept in print over so many years, books and materials that you were not going to be able to get down at your John Birch Society bookstore or on the shelves at Borders or Barnes & Noble. Jim Warner's newspaper, published by his Christian Defense League out of Metairie, Louisiana, also over the years contained so many valuable articles, bits of information. I just had occasion a couple months ago to go through a box of those papers and marveled at the amount of original material appearing therein. And some of the original material that appeared therein was from the late Eustace Mullen, who wrote pretty regularly for Dr. Warner. And although I mistakenly thought, and I mentioned this last week when I was talking about having Jim Warner on as a guest here, I thought that Jim and Eustace had known each other going way, way back. In fact, they didn't really actually meet until, I guess, the 1970s, and Jim can tell us about that. But Jim Warner has had his own fascinating career. He has probably been a bigger influence on more people than he realizes. And we are going to talk a little bit here tonight about Eustace Mullins, but we're going to talk about Jim's work, too. So it is with great pleasure and a great honor that I say welcome aboard, Jim Warner.
Okay, thank you, Mike.
Yeah, it's good to have you on here, Jim, because you really truly have been a great influence on me through your work, through your publications, and I know a lot of our listeners out there feel the same way, so I expect later in the hour we'll probably hear from a few people that want to call in and say hello.
That'd be great.
Yeah, Jim, we have just about 5 minutes here before the break. I wanted to give that lengthy introduction to kind of set the stage. To, you know, there's a lot of younger people out here listening to internet radio now who may not be familiar with your work, and I just wonder if you could give us a few minutes and tell us about your background.
Well, I got involved in here a long time ago when we were fighting against integration of the schools in the South and with the National States Rights Party when I was very young. I was around 20 years old or 18 years old. And I've been going ever since. We got beat down there, and it's sad to say that we were beat down, but mostly by the, not by the enemy, but by people that were officials in the South. They didn't want us to speak out and make any waves. So I could, you know, tell you more about that if you want later on. But it seems like our enemies were in at that time in our own camp with our own people, rather than the Zionists.
And, I'm laughing, Jim, because it occurs to me as I'm hearing you reminiscing about things that happened really so many years ago, and yet that same phenomenon goes on today. Our worst enemies are within our own so-called ranks in some respects, more so than even on the other side. Now, Jim, you have been a target, I'll tell you what, I know this for a fact. I know that you have been a target of the Anti-Defamation League for a long, long time, and I can say that with personal firsthand authority, because I remember back sometime in the mid-1980s when I had a guest visiting me at the office of the Spotlight in Washington. And at that time, he mentioned to me that he used to regularly attend meetings that you conducted when you were living in California. And the person who told me this was none other than the now infamous Roy Edward Bullock, who was subsequently unmasked as an agent of the Anti-Defamation League. And in fact, Jim Warner was one of their targets. And I know that, as I say, because Roy Bullock of the ADL admitted that to me. So that was kind of interesting. I think, in fact, unless I'm mistaken, Jim, it was either you and or Dr. Ed Field who first alerted Willis Cardo to the fact that Roy Bullock was an agent of the Anti-Defamation League. And, of course, after Willis became aware of this, we wrote about it in the Spotlight. And even according to Bullock himself, that set in motion the series of events that ultimately led to the FBI and the San Francisco Police Department investigating the ADL. Now, do you have any reminiscences about your meetings with this guy Bullock, who became a ubiquitous character?
I went to one of Willis's meetings. I think it was in Los Angeles now, if my memory is correct, way back in the 70s. In our 60s or 70s, and Roy Bullock was at the meeting, of course. He was a heavyset weightlifter type guy, you know, pretty big guy, you know.
But
he worked out at the gym, you know, you could tell that. And we went to a meeting and we went to lunch. And Willis was sitting down with some people sitting down in the same restaurant, and I was sitting there, and I noticed Roy Bullock. Somebody, I didn't know who he was at the time. He was sitting, somebody sitting at a booth right near Willis, and he was bending over, almost falling off the chair, trying to listen to what he was saying. And I found out he was Roy Bullock later on. I found out from somebody at the meeting. So I went over to Willis and I said, Willis, you know, this guy's a spy. He's been, every meeting we go to, he's at the meeting. And Willis said, I can't believe that, you know. And well, it worked out. It was true that he was a spy.
Absolutely.
But I pointed him out to Willis that he was a spy.
You know, that's the scary thing about it, because Bullock had been showing up periodically over a several years' time at the office of Liberty Lobby in Washington, and consequently, you know, he would come to the front desk and ask to see somebody from the editorial department. I was one of the junior staffers then, so they used to send me out front, and I got to know Bullock over this period of several years, and I had absolutely no idea that he was an ADL undercover agent. And, of course, he wasn't volunteering that information. But when I finally mentioned it to Willis Cardo, I mentioned that I knew this guy Bullock. It was then that Willis told me that he already had found out that that Bullock was an ADL agent. So, you know, it's funny, Jim. A lot of people think we're paranoid. when we talk about these people from the ADL and these other groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center, they think we're paranoid. They think we're overestimating our own importance, you know, that we're exaggerating the fact that these groups have interest in it. In fact, these guys have been around for a long, long time. And I suppose if you and a couple other folks and I sat down for a few minutes, we could probably come up with a list of about five or six other people that are just like Roy Bullock doing precisely the same thing.
Well, there's one way you can tell these people when they come to a meeting, if they're new, if they're middle-aged or young. They always talk about violence, about beating people up or knocking windows out or you know, doing something that's illegal, maybe not that that strong. But and as soon as I hear somebody talking like that at a meeting, my radar goes out, and I say, this guy's a spy or trying to get us into trouble, you know? That's my first thought.
Exactly.
Because they wouldn't be talking like that otherwise. You know, nobody I know talks like that. It's just not done.
Well, when you have an ulterior agenda, like a lot of these folks do, that's that's something else altogether.
Yeah.
All right, we are going up to our second break here. When we come back, we're going to get into a little discussion of Eustace Mullins, because if anybody ever was a target of the bad guys, it was Eustace Mullins, and so many of our listeners certainly know all about his good work. Stay tuned.
Oh, he was wonderful.
Here
was wonderful,
with our
man.
Special guest, James K. Warner.
Yeah, we'll send you Titanics from New York. Open up your eyes so you may see. Ask you not to read between the lines.
Yeah, we'll send you. All right, ladies and gentlemen, get your pen and paper handy, because later here during our broadcast, I'm going to get our guest, Jim Warner, to give out his contact information, so you want to have your pen and paper handy. Well, folks, we were talking here, we are going to be talking here, about the late Eustace Mullins a little bit. Now, Eustace was a prodigious researcher, and I can tell you firsthand that Jim Warner had a very valuable research library at his headquarters down there in Metairie, Louisiana. Over the years, he came to my aid, came to the support of Willis Cardo and the Barnes Review and the Spotlight and American Free Press, and providing us some valuable research material that we were able to utilize. And I know Eustace himself took advantage of the good offerings that Jim Warner had. So, Jim, if you could just go ahead and tell us a little bit about your own relationship with Eustace.
Well, I just have to explain a few things to begin with. When I was in the military, I was in the Air Force. I was assistant to the base commander, okay, in Hurlburt Field in Florida. And one day I heard about some people mentioned to me that a couple of truck drivers changed dumpsters out. You know what a dumpster is, you know, and bases and so forth. And they're garbage dumpsters that they haul away and bring in, and they were under investigation. And I didn't understand why, because I was like the fourth man in charge with the commander over there. Not that I was an officer, but I was still in a very important position. And I saw these guys coming out. They had been questioned by the base commander, and they were coming out of his office. And I walked through, and I said, why are they questioning you? What is the problem? Because I didn't know anything about, you know, I knew a little bit about politics, but not much at the time. And they said, well, they're after us because we're distributing a patriotic newspaper. And I said to these people, well, what is the newspaper? Could I see a copy? They said, well, we don't have copies with us right now, and we'd have to bring you one. I said, what is it? And they said, well, it's Common Sense. And I said, well, would you bring me some when you come on? I want to find out what's happening, because all I'm getting is reports that you guys are a bad influence here, that you might be subversive. So about a week later, these guys, they were just dumpster drivers, you know, they were nice guys. They brought me a whole bunch of Common Sense, and that's how I got onto this whole thing. Of course, my grandmother had been a follower of Father Coughlin, so that goes way back. And she was from Germany, and she was her father was a count in Germany. And so when I was a kid, even before I could really read good or anything, I saw Father Coughlin stuff all over her house before he was kicked off the radio. And so I was a little bit familiar with it. So anyway, it worked out where I got the common sense, and I wrote to them and got on their list. And that's where I found Eustace Mullins' publications. He had the Federal Reserve, which at the time he published out of, they published it out of New York, and it was under the first edition I have, and it was published by Casper and Horton. You know John Casper, don't you?
Oh yeah, I know the name. I never knew him, but I certainly
well, John
know the
Casper
name.
Was
yeah.
a guy mm-hmm. that was a patriot, and he was a flamboyant guy, and so was Mullins. You know, they were sort of the avant-garde of the right wing, you know, guys that were raising heck all the time and writing, and they hung around Greenwich Village and all this kind of stuff. And Casper and Horton published Mullison's book, The Federal Reserve, the first edition. Okay, well, so anyway, I had got a copy of that, and then later on, when I went to New Jersey, I went over to Common Sense after I'd become familiar with them, and I bought more copies. They had reprinted it. Well, I tell you what, Eustace Mullins had the best memory as far as he could remember almost anything. Anything we'd read on politics or history or anything. I mean, he didn't have a photographic memory. He just remembered. I don't know how he did it. And when I was talking to him all the time, I'd bring stuff up and he'd know everything, but he had a short-term memory when he was talking to somebody. Like if he was talking, he could tell me, when President of the United States did something, if I asked him, he could give me almost the quote of the publications and everything else. But when you were talking to him personally, he was always in a hurry. We went to some meeting or something, and I said, well, Millis, one time I asked him, he stopped publishing the, one of his books, and I asked him if I could do a printing of 500. And he told me, Biological Jew, one of the first books he published. It was about 80 pages. And he said, yeah, I'll give you permission, you know, just, and he sat down, he wrote out something to him, gave it to me. Well, about a year later when I published it, I sent him, I think, 100 copies. I did 500, sent him 100 as a gift, you know, to help him out with his, so a lot of people write in looking for it and they couldn't get it. So anyway, he wrote me a letter saying, oh, well, you published my book. And I said, well, hold on, I'm going to send you a copy of the letter you sent me. So I sent it and that was it. But he did the same thing with several other people. His memory was wonderful as far as dealing with facts that he'd read or knew about or looked up. He could tell you anything. But when it came to personal stuff, he was talking to so many people, went to meetings and everything, he just didn't remember a lot of stuff.
Well, this is it. This is what, you know, I commented on this to somebody recently, and I actually mentioned it on my radio show, that Eustace was everybody's friend. He was a very agreeable kind of guy. And if you'd be talking to him, he would contradict his own political point of view just to be nice to you. And as a consequence of that, he said during his final years, Eustace said a lot of things that people have picked up and put on the internet, and now they quote that as the gospel from Eustace Mullins. But you know what? I think the internet moved a little bit faster than Eustace did in the final years. Jim, I see the break coming up already. It's hard to believe we have another break coming up. Folks, we will be back with more from Dr. James K. Warner of the Christian Defense League, talking about Eustace Mullins and all sorts of other things which I know are of interest to you, the listeners. So hang in there, folks. Ask you not to read between the lines. Yeah, we'll send you glad tidings from New York. Open up your eyes so you may see. Ask you not to read between the lines. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are back. Michael Collins Piper here. We have a good 20-minute stretch ahead of us. Our guest is James K. Warner of the Christian Defense League. Right now, Jim, I would like you to give our audience some contact information from you so that they can drop you a note, send you a contribution, do something to help your important work.
Okay, we were flooded out. We were in Chalmette. First we were in Metairie and then Chalmette. And we were flooded out in Katrina. So here's our address now, the up-to-date address. It's a CDL, P.O. Box 9166, Mandeville, Mandeville, Louisiana, 70470. That's our current address. Like I said, we were flooded out in Katrina and then we had to move across the river.
Okay,
across
that's
the lake, rather.
Christian Defense League, or CDL, P.O. Box 9166.
Right.
Mandeville, Louisiana, and that's M-A-N-D-E-V-I-L-L-E, Louisiana, 70470.
Right,
I'm sure
that's
you'll
correct.
Get a few
I'll
notes.
Send you a packet of material and stuff, whatever you want. You know, it's just, we have plenty of material.
Yeah. Okay, now, Jim, we're talking about your Christian Defense League report. As I said, some of the most pivotal information that has ever crossed my own desk, and there's been a lot of it over the years, has come out of your publications. And, you know, the funny thing is, and I have mentioned this in my own book, Final Judgment, that after I wrote Final Judgment, which was first published in 1994, January of 1994, and was going through further files looking for additional information to put in a new edition of the book, I came across an older copy of your newspaper. And I reread that newspaper, as I've reread them many, many times, as people do when they keep valuable information in their files. And lo and behold, right there in front of me was an article that you had published probably maybe, I don't know, back in the mid-1980s, long before I ever wrote Final Judgment, in which in about five or six paragraphs, you raised the question as to whether or not there could have been or a Jewish or Israeli connection to the JFK assassination. And I read this, and I said, oh, my God. I said, I thought I was the first person to bring this up, but I said, no, Jim Warner did. So in a future edition of Final Judgment, I had to acknowledge that, hey, the first person, at least to my knowledge, to ever raise the possibility of Zionist involvement in the Kennedy assassination was Jim Warner of the Christian Defense League. Well, the point being that there was so much valuable information you published, and some of the best writings of Eustace Mullins that were ever published outside his books were published in the CDL report. I remember one lengthy piece that you published by Eustace on the life and crimes of J. Edgar Hoover, and I'm pretty sure that probably upset a lot of people because J. Edgar Hoover had his own peculiar following within the Patriot movement. I wonder if you could comment
right.
on that.
Well, he did a lot of articles for us. We have a bunch of stuff, but we lost some material in Katrina, about a third of our material in our publications. But whenever we needed articles, Eustace could really knock them out fast. He really had a tremendous memory. He knew all this stuff, and he'd been involved. He'd been hanging around Washington for so many years. He just knew everything that was going on. He just listened and watched everything.
Yeah,
he was really great. He really could pick stuff up. And when I said, well, Eustace, I need an article on this, you know. And a week later, he'd have an article in here, and it was all correct. I couldn't find anything wrong with it. You know, just everything was, he was writing everything he said. J. Edgar Hoover was no good, and J. Edgar Hoover was no good.
Yeah,
he was
well,
working
that's
with the ADL. He wrote a book for the ADL.
That's the funny thing about Hoover. I know Eustace and I actually had a conversation about the subject of Hoover on one occasion, because I remember telling Eustace that one time I had written something vaguely critical of Hoover that appeared, I don't know whether it was in the Spotlight or American Free Press, but I want to tell you, I got more than a few calls and letters from people who said, how dare you criticize J. Edgar Hoover? He was a fine patriot. And I said, let me show you what Eustace Mullins has written about it. And I copied that article from your newspaper and sent it to them, and I said, you want to know the lowdown on J. Edgar Hoover? Here it is from Eustace Mullins. So like you say, I mean, Eustace had been around Washington for a long, long time and knew an amazing number of people in both high and low places, so to speak. And
he was really on top of everything. He really knew what he was doing.
Yeah, you know, the thing about it is, it's kind of interesting because you describe him as being kind of avant-garde. What a lot of people don't know is Eustace was actually quite an accomplished painter, I'm told. He actually had a flair for the canvas, but you know, he got so sidetracked in his political writings that you know, that kind of prevented him from following through with his other talents. You know, it just like, well, I mean, anybody who's been political knows how that works. And Jim, you have been, well, I'll tell you what, and I don't mean to embarrass you, but Willis Cardo, whom you've been friends with for years, Willis, my boss, my longtime boss, told me that the first time he ever met you, Jim Warner, was when he visited you in jail. You had been arrested for some public protest that you were involved in, and Willis heard about you and traveled all the way to Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, the first and the only time he's ever been there. And that's where you guys met.
Well, no, it was Kingston, New York. And what we did is we had a bookstore, a patriotic bookstore in Kingston, okay? It's a college town. It's a college town. And we had Common Sense up in the windows. We had a storefront, me and one of our Greek patriots that has family living up there, and some other patriots from New Jersey. There were about six of us there, and I was in the store, and we'd take turns watching the store. Well, one night I had this individual came screaming into the place with a suit on and everything, and I found out he was a Jewish professor, and his name is Rabinowitz, and he said, "My name is Robinson, and that's Rabinowitz to you." And so, and then after him, about 15 students came into the store and start tearing down the stuff we had on the walls. And I grabbed a baseball bat and I swung at them. I didn't hit them, but they claimed I beat them all up and ran them out of the store. And then they claimed there was only five of them in the store. And so I went to court and went to jail for this for 6 months in Kingston.
Okay, all right.
I was put in jail. That's when Willis came up in Kingston to visit with me, and I was really glad to see him. I just wished at that time that I had mentioned, well, I didn't have any funds to do anything with, and I could have used some help, but I didn't mention anything. You know, I wasn't thinking about it. I was just glad to see him.
What year was that? Willis didn't remember. Do you remember what year it was?
That was about 1964.
Okay, 1964. I wasn't quite in grammars. I wasn't quite in nursery school yet, Jim.
Oh, Willis was good enough at least to come up and talk to me and see how I was and everything, which was great. And I spent 5 months in jail up there. And when I went to court with these people, the whole courtroom was filled with screaming Jews and students in the place, shouting and yelling curses and everything. And the poor judge up there, he wasn't a Jew, but he was shaking so bad he couldn't handle the papers. He was having a fit.
They were
so bad. I mean, if there was ever a lynch mob, it was at that time.
Jim, you know what? I guess I have to drive this point home to some of our listeners who may not be so in tune to the realities of the world. But for the last 60 years, the Jews have been the ones who've been telling us how the Nazis burned books. But here we have an example of you and a couple other law-abiding citizens trying to operate a bookstore in which you're selling patriotic literature, newspapers like Common Sense and other materials. And here a rabbi, I guess he was a rabbi, a professor.
No, his name says Robinson, but my real name is Rabbi Rabinowitz.
Okay.
Well,
well,
his family was the rabbi. That's the way they named their people.
This guy comes in and basically wrecks your store. And you're the one who ends up going to jail.
They tore the whole place up. They tore all the papers down off the walls and everything else, and I'm the one that gets arrested and goes to jail.
Yeah, now that's called, number one, it's a double standard. Number two, it's called book burning. And number three, it's just all too representative of the kind of tactics that the Jews have used against the rest of us here in the United States for as long as we can remember. But this just goes to show the audience, you know, here's a firsthand story of someone who's actually seen it in its face, and this is terrorism. This is terrorism. It's book burning, and yet Jim Warner is the one who goes to jail.
I went to jail, and what am I supposed to do? Just let them beat me up? And I just tried to fight back. I'm sorry I didn't hit him in the head with the baseball bat, but I missed. So they still put me in jail and claimed I hit them.
It wouldn't have made any difference either.
It wouldn't have made any difference at that point. Really, there were like 15 or 20 of them came into the store and were tearing everything up. So what am I supposed to do? I mean, I couldn't even move. They were pushing me against the wall and everything. So I mean, they just were hateful.
Well, this has been this has been the tactics. You know, a couple of weeks ago we had Mark Glenn here in the program. I think you probably met Mark at the
years ago
World Wars for Israel conference in California. Well, you know, Mark, Mark, and of course I've been threatened. A lot of people have been threatened by the Jewish Defense League. You've certainly had your share of efforts of intimidation.
Well, they threatened us many times when we were in California.
Well, absolutely, and yet they are secretly controlled and funded by the Anti-Defamation League, which publicly postures as a civil rights organization, and yet they're basically the street thugs for the ADL and for the fancy Jewish businessmen and publishers and other folks that give money to them. So
Mike, these people are so raised as racist, so much raised as racist, that they just react immediately when we even speak up or we start a bookstore or anything. They just react. It's just their instincts. They're raised like this since they're children. You know, the problem is that they were been raised this way for 5,000 years. And when we're born, we're raised, and all we got is about 50, 60, 70 years, and we die off, and our parents don't tell us anything or fill us into anything. We have no secret religious beliefs like they do. And then we're taught as Christians that we should be lovable and love everybody and love these people, and they're going to beat us up and kill us, and we should be wonderful people, you know, and be nice to them because they're some kind of special people from God. Well, it's not that way. These people are vicious and hateful, and believe me, they go to these Jewish schools, and they learn how to be hateful. That's what they teach them. And they don't say, well, go and get the goyim. They put it into their religious beliefs and their books, and these little Jews don't even know they're being brainwashed. I mean, it's not like saying, okay, go ahead and attack the goyim and break his leg or something. It's just the way they're taught. They're taught to react like a dog is taught to react to bite somebody that's breaking in your house. The dog does what he's trained to do without even knowing it.
You know, it's very interesting. It's kind of interesting because just this afternoon, or I should say yesterday afternoon, Mark Glenn and I were exactly discussing this very thing, that we constantly keep hearing the Jewish leaders and the Jewish organizations complaining about anti-Semitism. But then in the next breath, we hear them quoting their own religious teachings that say that we're cattle. They call us goyim. They teach that a non-Jewish life doesn't have the value of a Jewish life. And they wonder why so many people over so many thousands of years have always been upset at their behavior.
But the thing of it is, Mike, they've been taught this for 5,000 years or more. And this just goes on from generation to generation. We come to America, we come here from Britain, and we come here from Europe, and we came here as babes in the woods. We have no background. We have no racial teachings. We have no Talmud. We have no Jewish books. We were just brought here as individuals and dropped off, like somebody being dropped off at the street corner to catch a bus. And we're dropped off without any knowledge at all of who we are, what we're supposed to do, what we're supposed to believe, what we're supposed to read. These people are trained like this since they're their children. They go to these Torah schools. They're nothing but racist education places, and they know how to cover up what they're doing in a very clever way where these little Jews don't even know they're being brainwashed. I mean,
I wish that we had
a system like that, but we don't. We're just babes in the woods, so to speak.
Our whole race. One of the books that you used to make available, Jim, was the book "Jews Must Live" by this Jewish writer. I think his name was
Marcus Eli Ravitch. He published that in the 1920s. Yeah.
Yeah, this book explains this mindset, and it's very unnerving to someone who has been raised to think that, oh, well, the Jews are just like everybody else. They just go to a different church. They're just like we are, and don't be prejudiced against them, because if you talk to them, you'll find they're just like your other next-door neighbor who's a Catholic or who's a Baptist or who's a member of the Seventh-day Adventist. They're just like everybody else, but the difference is, in fact, the Jews are taught that they are not like everybody else, and that, in fact, they are superior to everybody else.
But they've taught their people in such a way as that these young Jews don't even realize what they're being taught. They're made racist without realizing it. If we did the same thing and started a school, someplace to train our people, we'd have to tell people the truth from the very beginning of everything we know, and then, of course, we'd be attacked and put out of business. But they do it under religion. And the only one I ever knew that was a great patriot on the religious end was Dr. Wesley Swift, and he was telling his people this whole story about this stuff until he died in 1971 or 70. I mean, but he was him and Dr. Comfrey, just a few identity preachers of all that's been between us and them. And believe me, we're babes in the woods to be in this battle with people that have been put passed on their teachings for 5,000 or more years. I mean, I'm not rephrasing Hitler, but I mean, think of this. He had 12 years to try to educate his people with half of his people going to church and believing the Jews are God's chosen people. So how do you win a war against them when they're destroying your country and putting communism in your country and your people don't know what's going on? It's not even that do know what's going on. I think they're supposed to be pro-Jewish because they're Christian. How do you fight this? I mean, I'm surprised Hitler lasted 12 years. I really am.
You know, it's interesting, Jim. You know, I've heard so many people talk about this issue from a variety of perspectives, but I think you're the first person I ever heard put it quite distinctly and so correctly that us Americans, we just kind of got dropped here and we, without being told exactly what we were supposed to be. That's interesting.
Like a baby dropped off in a basket by parents that don't want him, you know? It's almost that, you know, I would say with that. I would compare that, wouldn't you?
That's interesting. That's damned interesting. We have a break coming up here, folks, so stay tuned. We'll have our last 5 minutes before the second hour begins. And remember, if you want to call in here and talk to Dr. James K. Warner, the number is 1-800-313-9443. 313-9443. All right, folks, we're back with our special guest, James K. Warner. You know, Jim, during the break, I was thinking back to something going back many, many years. You provided me some very interesting research information on a very controversial character whom you knew and who he's been talked about a bit over the years, a guy by the name of Dan Burroughs, who was actually of Jewish descent, but he was involved in a lot of right-wing activities in the United States, and then he later died. People say it was a suicide. Other people say maybe he was murdered, but could you comment on Dan Burroughs?
Dan Burroughs was sincere. There's very few Jews that are even sincere, even reading history. There's very few that have really so-called converted, and I don't think it was a conversion. I think they were racially right to begin with. You understand? But they had a bad religion. But
right.
That's
right,
just very
right.
Few in the Bible. I mean, I can't name more than 15 over the history of several thousand years that came out like that. I believe Dan Burroughs was a sincere person. He knew about what was going on. I knew him always to be a loyal person. He was always on the, when you needed him somewhere, he was always, I never knew him to be a bad person. I never knew him to be pro-Jewish. I knew him, his father from what I called up a couple times before all this happened with him supposedly committing suicide. And I talked to him on the old man answered the phone. His father had been in the German army in World War I. And he had been shot in the throat. So whenever I called it, this old man would have this funny voice, you know, like your throat's been cut out or something.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And he would get down to the phone. Evidently, Dan kept all this stuff at his house. He collected all kinds of German stuff and everything, World War II. And then swords and books and everything. And he had it all in his house in his basement. And his sister and the father and the mother, nobody seemed to care about it. So evidently, they weren't in with the Jews to begin with. They were Jewish, but they weren't. In such a way. And what happened is this reporter from the New York Times found out Burroughs had been born a Jew in New York and was going to expose him in the New York Times, put a major article. And Burroughs' whole life had been around people that were patriotic, you know, people that knew what the Jews were up to and everything. And he wasn't religiously Jewish. He wasn't a Jew and maybe he was born racially, but he wasn't a Jew by mentality.
Right.
So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, to him, his whole life was based in the right wing, with being with right wing people, a very, very, scarce person, you know, in history. And, I always knew him to be loyal. You see, what he got in trouble with is he was a fanatic about collecting stuff. And what he did in New York that got him in trouble is he put some Nazi stamps from World War II along with American stamps on a letter and sent it to somebody, and the post office department came down on him like a hammer.
And they
put him in jail for 5 or 10 years for this so-called crime, because the German stamps were on the envelope, the Nazi stamps. That's where he caved in. I think he caved into that. And then after that, as soon as that happened, a few months later, then the New York Times is coming out with an article exposing him as being a Jew because they couldn't get to him any other way. I think he probably did kill himself because it was just it was too traumatic for him.
Yeah, well, this is it. You know, I over the years, people have brought his name up to me, and they said, "Oh, don't you think he was just an ADL agent, an infiltrator?" And I've said to them that I knew what your opinion on the matter was because we had discussed it. I said, "No, I said Jim Warner knew this guy and thought that he was sincere." So that just
he was just frightened and scared. I think at that point he thought he was going to jail for several years. They had put him in a prison outside of Los Angeles for 6 or 8 months or someplace, and New York. I'm sorry. He'd been in jail before for demonstrations and stuff up there, so I think he was very scared to go back. You understand that he might be killed or something.
Okay,
he panicked.
I hear the music coming up, folks.
All
we
right.
are going off to our hour break. We will be right back with
All
Jim
right.
Warner. Stay tuned.
So you may see. Ask you not to read between the lines. Hope that you will come right in on the time. In the
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Michael Collins Piper here, coming to you from Washington, headquarters of American Free Press. Check it out at AmericanFreePress.net. And check out the Barnes Review History Magazine at BarnesReview.com. Hey, folks, we have a special guest here. And when I say a special guest, I mean a special guest, because I don't have a lot of guests on this program. But our special guest here tonight is Dr. James K. Warner, longtime publisher of the Christian Defense League Report, a real pioneer in the truth movement here, ladies and gentlemen. Somebody who's been at this for a long, long time, and as you can see, he is still a very youthful, energetic guy who hasn't lost a bit of spirit, despite the fact that he's been roughed up, jailed, defamed, spied upon, and God knows what else in his long, and I would say prestigious, career. You can write Jim Warner, care of the Christian Defense League, or simply CDL at P.O. Box 9166, Mandeville, Louisiana. No longer Metairie, it's Mandeville, M-A-N-D-E-V-I-L-L-E, Mandeville, Louisiana, 70470. Jim, welcome back to the second hour, and appreciate you coming aboard.
No, I'll tell you, Dan Burroughs was a good guy. I think Roy Frankhauser probably made him panic to kill himself. Roy Frankhauser, I think, sold out, was an agent for the ADL or somebody.
Well, you know what? You just took the words right out of my mouth. I was going to ask you about Roy Frankhauser. He just died a few years ago, and he had been a very ubiquitous and enigmatic. I like those words, ubiquitous and enigmatic character, and there was definite evidence that he had, in fact, been on the ADL payroll, and he was certainly working at various times for U.S. intelligence, and he was the guy who was with Dan Burroughs at the time Dan Burroughs died, and that's where a lot of people raised that question as to whether Dan Burroughs was murdered, but I think you take a more nuanced position.
I think Dan was frightened to death of going to jail, you know, and being exposed. From all the articles I've seen, what Dan Burroughs was afraid of, the only friends he really had were people in the patriotic movement. And if he lost those friends, that was basically the end of his life. And he lived for the movement. I'll tell you that right now. I don't care what he was born or anything. He was a special case. to me. And he was afraid that he was being exposed by the New York Times, where the article came out after he died, and that he was going to lose all his friends and all his support. And I think just Roy Frankhauser was staying at Roy's house in Reading, Pennsylvania, and I think Roy just nagged him to death and pushed him over the edge to kill himself. I think that's what happened.
That's a very interesting analysis. And you know what, Jim? From everything I've read and heard from people who knew Roy Frankhauser, who dealt with him, that sounds like that's probably as close to what we can ever get as to what really did happen there. You know, speaking of this kind of thing, talking about the agents and so forth from the ADL and people like that. This guy Roy Frankhauser was moving a lot in a lot. Well, repeating myself here, but Frankhauser obviously was one of these intelligence operatives. Now, you have spent a lot of time in recent years in New Orleans, and the city of New Orleans, as you know, it's probably as different in reality as what people imagine it to be. But
right.
One thing that has always bothered me about New Orleans has been the fact that the city has been dominated for so long by the Times-Picayune newspaper, which of course is owned by the Zionist Jewish Newhouse family. And I know that when old Mr. Newhouse bought the New Orleans Times-Picayune, he bragged, "I just bought New Orleans." And I just wondered if you could comment on the political... Oh, well, here we go to the break already.
Okay, get your ass. Okay.
On to the break already. We're going to be right back with Jim Warner. Stay tuned, folks. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're back. As we went to the break, I was posing a question to our guest, Dr. James K. Warner. Jim, I was talking about the city of New Orleans and its environs. It's always been dominated by the Newhouse family-owned Times-Picayune newspaper, at least during the last 25 years.
Since integration came in, he bought up a bunch of papers, not just one.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, well, that's what I wanted to talk to you about. I wanted to just kind of get an idea of how they dominate the politics of the community.
Well, what they do is he knew there was going to be integration in these areas, and he bought up the papers. These non-Jews sold out to him, and some of them went on as editors for life and things like that. You know, they got their payoffs. They got their money. They didn't have to work there anymore. So Newhouse just used these papers to put propaganda out, pushing the idea of integration and against anybody, any patriot that was fighting it. And that's what happened. They did a thing and attacked me for 5 days in a row when I had made some statements in the front page articles. I mean, it wasn't local reporters. It was reporters they brought in from all over the country to get me. And they did it. I mean, they destroyed me down here. I mean, you know, it's just one day after. I've never seen in my whole life a situation where a newspaper runs articles attacking your life 5 days in a row in the first page in the newspaper. 5 days in a row to destroy me.
Yeah, well, now, there we go. This just this comes back to what I was saying earlier. You know, we talk about the power of the press, and here you've experienced it firsthand, and it's coming out of the Newhouse Press. And the Newhouse family, of course, are big financial backers, in fact, of the New Orleans office of the ADL in particular. I know that for a fact. So these attacks on you were coming right out of the Jewish power elite, and that's, I guess, the price you have to pay when you dare to speak out. With Hurricane Katrina, of course, we all know New Orleans has lost population considerably, and now the Newhouse family has trimmed back publication of that newspaper to only a couple days a week.
Thank God.
Exactly. Well, that's interesting. Now, I guess that is a good way of looking at it, yeah. Well, I guess, Jim, in that respect then, I mean, how can people in local community, I mean, here's the thing. Here's a city like New Orleans, which in many respects is about as American as you can get, and yet, on the other hand, it's very different from the rest of America. But the Newhouse family, they own medium-sized newspapers in medium-sized cities across the country. And then we have the bigger newspapers. I guess I'm asking, Jim, how can local people fight back when their local newspapers are controlled by these powerful Jewish interests. I mean, what can we do? I don't know.
Well, they won't put letters to the editors in for you unless they're watered down about segregation. You know, nothing of the real stuff will get like Willis publishes and things will ever be in those papers. I mean, they'll talk about integration and somebody about various problems, conservative problems, and they just don't let anybody speak out. So what are you going to do? I mean, I can't go down and force them to put articles in the paper that I want my views. They say, well, where's the money for the ads? You know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
And it's all free for them. It's all space fillers, it was. So, I mean, when they want to attack, they just attacked. And what can you do? What am I going to go down with $10,000 to pay for a page ad for a day?
Right, exactly.
You can't do things
like that.
This
is what I mean. You know, people just don't... A lot of people, Jim, just don't really understand how deeply rooted this Jewish media control really is. You know, it's like they, you know, they don't quite get it. They maybe see their local weekly or daily newspaper, and they don't understand what's going on when you have one of the richest families in the world controlling, you know, all these newspapers across the country and dominating the media right there in the local community. So you've just described it to us. 5 days in a row, you're on the front page of your local newspaper.
Front page. That's key space. I mean, my picture's on the front. Everything in my house. Put pictures of my house. Opened. Well, they did. They did attack my house. But I mean, later on, a few years later, somebody attacked one of our buildings and smashed out the front with a car. But I mean, the thing of it is, I mean, they did this on purpose. They put the picture of my house that I had before the flood in the paper with the picture and everything, the street I was on, so somebody would attack me.
Well, there, that's exactly right. I'm glad you pointed that out. You know, I had forgotten that, but I remember either reading about that or you telling me about that. That's what people need to understand. I mean, you know, when there are stories about politicians in the paper, or when there are stories about, they don't put the pictures of their homes and tell where they live. But here, one of the most distinguished Jewish families in America, which gives their money to one of the most distinguished Jewish organizations in America, the Anti-Defamation League, they use their daily newspaper in New Orleans to attack you and to focus on you, and they even put your picture of your house and name.
And the address.
Yeah.
And the address.
Yeah.
Can you believe this?
Now, how many people out there, I know we have a few people who listen to this program who don't agree with what you and I are saying here, and they're sitting back thinking how really rotten and terrible we are for saying what we're saying here tonight. But I wonder how they would feel if you or I were to publish their picture in our newspapers and publish their address and say, hey, this is where Mr. and Mrs. So-and-so or Rabbi and Mr. and Mrs. So-and-so, Rabbi and Mrs. So-and-so live. People would be condemning us left and right. They'd say that Mike Piper and Jim Warner and Willis Cardo were trying to stir up hate, that we were trying to get people to hurt these people. But they do it to you, and that's called reporting. That's called journalism. Well, that's...
Yeah, no, there's nothing you can do about it. What can you do? There's no way I can pay $10,000 a page to counter them.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know of anybody that could do that.
Yeah, it's so rare.
None of our people.
Yeah, I mean, the Newhouse family alone at one time, Stephen Birmingham, the society writer, said they were the second richest Jewish family in America. And just a few years ago, Fortune magazine ranked the Newhouse family, the brothers Donald and Cy, at, the eighth richest people in America. So yeah, your resources don't quite come up to the eighth richest family in America, eighth and ninth richest family in America.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean,
I'm just
a guy and they're attacking me with it. It's easy for them to attack somebody when they have all the money and all the influence and we have nothing.
Yeah, and it's getting increasingly more so that they have all the money and the influence and we have even less than we ever did before. But, you know, let me ask you, on a bigger picture, Jim, I guess, you know, you've been at this for so long. Do you see the situation, as a consequence of the Internet, I'll pose that question specifically. Do you see the Internet as being a positive thing in terms of fighting this monster, or do you see the internet as maybe having become problematic?
Well, it would be positive. I really thought I was really enthused with it. I thought it was really going to be positive when it first came out. But what they're doing is there's so many idiots going on. They're putting crap on there and stealing everybody's material. And I mean, everything you publish, everything we publish, is being put on by people anonymously on the net. So if we want to sell different things, even our books, our booklets, they're stealing everything. So how do you fight back from that? They deprive you of a livelihood. They're supposedly pretending they're patriots, and but they don't do any research or write any books. They just take everybody else's stuff. So it's really a detriment almost. Really, you're supposedly getting the word out, but I don't know how we're supposed to do it, to be honest with you.
Yeah, you know, see, that is the problem. That is the problem with the Internet. And I don't think a lot of people who are, you know, so many people are constantly on the Internet, and they're on the Internet searching for information, and they know what they're looking for. But this is what... But most of the average Americans out there who are accessing the Internet, they think it's really something. They think it's really special that they can get on the Internet and read the New York Times, or they can read the Los Angeles Times, or they can read the Washington Post on the Internet, and they think they're really informed as a consequence of that, and they don't know that they can come to sites like Republic Broadcasting and listen to this broadcast. They have no reason to know. You know, so that is a sorry thing about the Internet, that in some ways it almost seems like it's becoming like we're circling the wagons rather than on the attack, if you know what I mean. It's,
right.
Yeah.
If you notice on the Internet, more and more you're not able, when the Internet first came out for the first 10 years or so, you could get to any site you wanted and just run off newspaper articles and stuff. Now, I'm not saying to reprint or anything, just to run them off for doing articles and things. But now, everything is, they stop you from getting to anything unless you subscribe to their publications.
Yeah.
You notice that?
Yeah, that's one of the big debates that's going on, you know, as to how to do this, you know, how to bring traffic to places and so forth. And, you know, and it's so controlled. I mean, when you go on Google now, if you innocently type the word Jew in, Google then will, you know, some person just types in the word Jew in a Google search, Google sends up all these messages that say, oh, we hope you weren't offended by anything you found here. And if you want to get the truth about Jewish people, please go to the website of the Anti-Defamation League. Things like this. So yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure really. I keep going back and forth on it. I'm not sure really if the Internet has been that valuable in the bigger picture. I know I've used it successfully for communication with people, and making contact with people I would have not probably had otherwise had contact with. But in terms of really getting our message out there, I'm not so sure.
Well, I'll tell you what, before I forget, there's a thing I just caught about a week ago. It's from Russia. It's English language with people that speak Russians that speak perfect English.
We have a break coming up.
Oh, okay, go ahead. I'll tell you when you come back.
Yeah, hold that thought. All right, we have a couple callers here, folks. We'll be going to you shortly, but we will be back with Dr. James K. Warner. Stay tuned, folks.
Open up your eyes so you may see. Ask you not to read between the lines.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Michael Collins Piper here with Dr. James K. Warner. We do have a couple callers, actually three callers lined up, and we'll go right to you. In the meantime, before we went to the break, Jim, you were talking about a website.
There's a Russian language news channel now. It's RT.com, and they have offices in Washington, D.C. It is the best channel in the world. These people have everything. They don't hit the Jews, but they hit the Federal Reserve almost every two or three days as a rotten bunch of bums, and they're attacking them on there, and they're attacking the housing swindle and swindling people out of money on their properties, and up to date news on the Middle East that tells the truth. You've really got to get your people to tune into it. It's called RT.com. And they'll, you go on their site and they'll give you the directions to get on to everything. And this is 24-hour satellite news from Russia, and it's wonderful. They got things defending the Palestinians, everything else.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I think I'm familiar with that. I think it may be Russia Today or that RT.com.
Yeah, Russia Today, I think it is RT, but it's wonderful.
Yeah.
RT.com. Just go to RT, tell your people if they got computers, go to RT.com and they're gonna get the whole works that they can read over and copy down and get in touch with them. Because it's really, when I go to one channel, I say Wolf Blitzer and I go see, the other idiot on Fox, I mean, it makes me want to throw up, and I see these people on here, and it's 80% of it is stuff that's just wonderful.
You know, that's funny, Jim, because I was just thinking, as you were talking about that I know in your newspaper over the years, you had a lot of very interesting foreign news that obviously never appeared anywhere else in the American press, and it made it very, very clear to me that at least overseas, as much Jewish power and influence as there is in so many of these countries, of the West, that there's always been just a little bit more openness and freedom in the media itself than there is in the United States, at least in my opinion. What do you think about that?
Well, going by the Russian channel, I mean, it's one. While I had the TV turned down, the tone off. But while I was waiting for you to get back to the phone, they had a guy on from antiwar.com. Can you believe this?
Okay.
The program.
Yeah, well, see, there you go. I mean, see, there are good things out there. That, you know, it goes both ways. I guess
on this
channel
or on RT.
Yeah, I always said that one of the first things I'd do when I became dictator was shut down the internet, and then I would spend an entire week deciding what I thought should be on the internet and what shouldn't be there.
Well, I'm telling you, if you got people listening to this and they go to RT and they like it and they watch the show, I don't know what chance, different channels all over the country, they're getting in almost every community now in America by satellite. If you like it, get your friends to get onto it. I mean, you're going to find some stuff you don't like on there. Everybody finds something they don't like about anything and everything.
Exactly, but at least
you're going to find something you disagree with, but it's 90% of this stuff is hitting at what the people that destroy not only America, but the world. And I'm really surprised that even Russia puts this stuff out. So Vladimir Putin's doing something right.
Yeah, well, no, exactly. See, that's my point, that it's funny that you can actually...
Right now, there's a program on civil split, fear over controversial Israel army Arab enlisting. The Orthodox Jews and Arabs do not want to go in the Israeli military anymore. They're revolting over there, but it's only on this channel.
Yeah,
right,
see,
now.
So there you go. I mean, they're actually getting more freedom in some respects in their media in other countries than we are here in the United States.
They're up to what we were doing before. But, you know, I just had to tell you that people should get something besides Wolf Blitzer and Fox News.
You know, it's funny, Jim. I was watching cable when I was out of town a couple weeks ago, and as different as all the major mainstream networks are in their news reporting, they're all really the same. They have a different veneer, but you know, you get underneath that veneer and it's the same cheap wood that's really, really put together in a haphazard fashion, and there's not much substance to it, you know?
I wish you people would, a lot of people, if they're listening to this thing, they would get on RT.com. They can like it or dislike it, but they're going to find mostly stuff they like on there, including attacking the Federal Reserve and trying to destroy it.
Yeah, I mean, to even find that kind of coverage on an issue like that, here in the United States, I mean, even though people... They will talk about the Federal Reserve, but not to the degree, not in the same realm that Eustace Mullins would have. But it sounds to me like this RT.com is definitely an alternative to the American media. And again, it comes down to people, you know, people being able to find these alternatives and to recognize them.
I found it by accident. I didn't know about it. I was just going through the channels and it came across. I said, man, this is not Wolf Blitzer for sure. Let me tell you.
That's an interesting way of looking at a media presentation. This is not Wolf Blitzer. I like that. right. Well, Jim, we are going to be going up to our half-hour break, and when we come back, I think we've got some callers up here who are anxious to talk to you. So
I'm sorry to have interrupted you a bit, but
I just had to tell
your people about this because they're going to have a ball with this station.
Yeah, I mean, you know, anything to get the word out. That's the important part.
So. Right.
There you go. All right, well, we are going to the break, ladies and gentlemen. When we come back, we have 3 callers lined up right now, maybe a few more, but we'll try to squeeze you all in during our final half hour. This is Michael Collins Piper, and you know the number here. It's 800-313-9443, and you can write Dr. Jim Warner, care of CDL, Christian Defense League, P.O. Box 9166, Mandeville, Louisiana, 70470. That's Mandeville, Louisiana, 70470.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Michael Collins Piper here from Washington with our special guest, Dr. James K. Warner, who is literally a guy who has been there and done that. And I can tell you out there listening in the audience that you can be lucky also that it hasn't been done to you what's been done to Jim. Anyway, we have some callers lined up here. We have Alex from New York who's been sitting quite patiently waiting to come aboard. Alex, please come aboard.
Hello again, Mike.
How you doing, Alex? What's going on?
Everything's great. Say, James?
Yes.
Have you ever watched Press TV?
Press TV? No, I don't believe I have.
Oh. That's another channel. Great one. They talk about the Jews there sometimes.
Press
well,
TV
is really great
the Iranian... it's an Iranian-sponsored television station.
It's from Iran.
Oh, that Press TV, I'm going to have to watch it then. Not that I have any connection, but I mean, you got to watch RT.com. You're going to love it.
Yeah, I watch it every day, every day.
Oh, well, then okay, so that's good.
But there's, I was about to call it the Aspen Gold to Keith Johnson. Was there. I'm a big fan of Keith Johnson, You know him, right?
No, I'm not familiar with him.
He's right, for American freedom.
There's one guy on there talks about the Federal Reserve every day on RT, man. He's really great.
Yeah.
Tearing it down.
Can't have Mike on, mate. Can't have Mike.
Alex, you know, we have a very bad connection there.
I was about to talk to Keith Johnson's interview recently. Keith Johnson's interview.
Wait, you know, I have such a bad connection with you. Could you repeat that, Alex?
Keith Johnson's interview. Keith, you know Keith, Revolta Plebs?
He writes for American Free Press. Yeah, what did you say about him?
I'm a big fan of him.
He's a good man. He's one of the more intelligent people out there writing today, I have to say that.
No, but, like, he recently reviewed a guy, Sasson, and Sasson's just an idiot. A pure idiot. I mean, literally,
you know, Alex, I am absolutely
recent review of Sasson, and he's Sasson ignorant man because he doesn't like
Alex, listen, I'm sorry. I'm just going to have to cut you off because I cannot hear a single word you're saying, and what I do hear you saying, it keeps jumping in and out. So I'm just going to have to move on here. I'm sorry about that. I don't know if it's your phone or what the problem is, but we're going to have to move on here. I'm sorry about that. Okay, let's move to New Mexico with E.T.
Hello, Mr. Piper.
Okay, how are you today, E.T.?
I'm doing good. How are you?
All right.
Listening to you two, I feel like I'm in on a big secret. You know, all roads lead to Israel. Any researcher who doesn't acknowledge this is not worth his salt. You know, I'm not a racist, and I've never have I been a white supremacist. But when you do the math, all roads lead back to Israel.
No? Well, you know, I'm not sure that's necessarily the case, because there were a lot of problems going on in this world before the State of Israel was established in 1948. So I mean, I guess maybe those roads led up to Israel in 1948, but I guess maybe I'm saying that that the picture goes a little bigger than Zionism. What do you think about that?
I agree totally. It's been, it's very old. Yeah. And they've been dividing this country, and they're pitting the blacks against the whites, and they keep us fighting amongst ourselves instead of looking at the real enemy. You know, it's unbelievable. And I wonder, why are they so secret and clandestine? You know, why don't, if they own everything, they own the Senate, they own the Congress, they own Hollywood, they run the New York Times, they run it all, they run everything. Why are they so secretive and clandestine?
Well, you know, I'm not so sure they are secretive in a sense, maybe, because, you know, I mean, I read Jewish newspapers all the time, and I'm talking about Jewish community newspapers, and in those Jewish community newspapers, they brag openly about their power and influence, and you know, you turn to the mainstream newspapers, and their message is out there. Jim Warner, what do you think about that?
They do put their message out there in these papers. They're not shy about it. I mean, going back to about 1918, 1917, they used to talk about them being a race and everything. I've had it in my publications, but they don't do that anymore. They cover it up a bit, but it's still the same. It's still the same song and dance. And they do admit certain things, but you just got to be more clever to pick it up now.
Yeah, that's kind of what it's kind of funny, because Mark Glenn and I, again, I this is the second time I've cited my conversation with Mark Glenn yesterday, but Mark and I have these weekly powwows in which we get into some of this stuff, get down and dirty, and you know, we were talking about that it's really become so in your face now, at least in Mark's opinion and in my opinion, that every time you turn around, we're getting more of this Zionist Jewish garbage shoved in our faces and down our throats and through other orifices and we're just supposed to say nothing about it and accept it because, well, they're God's chosen people and there was a Holocaust and 95 million Jews were killed and things like that. So E.T., how do you mean they're clandestine? Because I don't think there's anything clandestine about them at all.
Mr. Piper, that just because the average man on the street doesn't seem to have any clue about Jewry, international Jewry, and you take even in Hollywood, if any like my peers, like you take Brad Pitt, who just was in that piece of trash, Inglourious Basterds.
Oh yeah.
And, I mean, if there's anyone in Hollywood or in the music industry that says boo against Jew, they're out. They're out. And they've been brainwashed and mind controlled not to even think about it.
Well, you know, I tell you, I mean, that's an obvious, I mean, you know, when we're talking about hardcore economics there, but I mean, you look even at Mel Gibson, as much grief as he caught from the Jews, his film, The Passion of the Christ, was one of the biggest box office smashes of all time, making Mel Gibson very personally a very wealthy man. And I'm not so sure. See, I guess what I'm saying is that as much power as the Jews have, as bad as their influence is and as negative as it is, they can't control everybody all the time, and they can't force people not to go to see motion pictures that people want to see. And yet, despite the fact they campaigned against Mel Gibson, people showed up to see his movies. So I mean, I think we're in agreement, but I think we're just kind of looking at it from a different perspective.
Okay, well, I just read a really, really good book. We were talking about Russian television, and I recommend this book. It's by Alexander Solzhenitsyn. It's called The Gulag Archipelago.
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
And that's a really good book, a good read for any, I'd recommend. So, thanks, Mr. Piper, Mr. Warren. You guys have
Thank
a good
you.
Night.
I appreciate you. Oh, E.T. You know, I might mention, folks, you just talked about Solzhenitsyn's book, The Gulag Archipelago. The Barnes Review has published in a special issue extensive English language translations of the book by Solzhenitsyn about the Russian-Jewish relationship. This book by this Nobel Prize winner is available only in Russian, will never be published in the United States because it talks about the Jewish role in communism, written by one of communism's most articulate critics, Alexander Solzhenitsyn. It is available from the Barnes Review. Okay, we have another caller. We have Darren calling from America. Darren, go ahead.
Good evening, gentlemen. Can you hear me okay, first off?
Absolutely.
Very good. I'm calling in from Magic Jack, so if my connection gets a little fuzzy, just let me know.
Oh, it sounds real good.
Very good. Great show tonight. When I first heard the words Bolshevik, I thought, wow, okay, let's see where they go with this. And you guys are right on. You're right on target. I've been talking to a lot of people about what the Bolsheviks and who the Bolsheviks were and how the genocide in Germany pales in comparison to what the Bolsheviks did to the Russian people. Good Russian, good people. Very good people. And they come in and they just murdered, 100 million? We don't know. Your comment about RT, I want to shed some light on that. I had a neighbor who was picking up RT off of his antenna, his aerial antenna. And I kept walking into my mom's house, and she was watching CNN or something like that, and I had to just, I couldn't just stand there all the time and tell her where the lies were as Wolfie Baby was speaking. And so I said, look, we have to get RT. And she wouldn't, buy any more cable, so I put an antenna on her roof, and we cut cable. And now all she watches is RT.
Isn't it a wonderful program? It's wonderful. I mean, it's just great. It's like a breath of fresh air.
That's interesting. Over the break, I checked out their website, and I was amazed at the factual information just right there on the website alone. Yeah.
It is. Let's be clear about this. This television station just didn't appear by accident. It is there for a reason. And I would say this is something Bolshevik. I don't know, but it's there for a reason. It didn't just show up, haphazardly. Oh, look, here's the truth finally. No.
Wolf Blitzer, that's for sure. That's right.
And I have to agree with, however, it's a great program, and I enjoy watching it. However, I haven't watched it in about a month and a half. I've been off of cable and away from the television for a while. But I started to notice that they're not telling some truths. And let's be clear about something. They're not identifying the New World Order. And as long as they don't identify the New World Order, they're not telling the whole truth. And we need to hold them to that accountability publicly and on a program like this. RT needs to get their act together if that's possible. If this isn't just another ploy, just another level of deception. The media, I've worked in the media. I worked as an actor, I worked as a scriptwriter, in front and behind the camera, built sets, and you guys are dead on when you say Jews, gays, and gay Jews. One-third of the industry fits that category. I left because I just got tired of it.
Right.
The The New World Order needs to be identified in the news, or it is not legitimate news.
Now, I tell you, Dan, I know where you're coming from, and I don't disagree with you. I would just comment that these guys over there at RT.com, wherever they're coming from, literally, whoever is backing them, but I mean, what I'm saying is that they're probably at this juncture doing just about what they can do, because when you start going beyond a certain step and talking about the New World Order, that's when you start having to engage in a whole new process of educating people. But
that's right.
I understand your point. I'm not disagreeing with you at all. I'm just kind of reflecting on what they're probably trying to do, if they're trying to do what we hope they're trying to do, qualifying it that way.
Well, let me qualify that. You're right. And I don't want to take away what RT is and the valuable tool that it is. I came home after being away from home for a dozen years and met up with a friend. And over the two-year process that I was there, I had to deprogram a friend who was reading a lot of books. He was reading Tom Hartman and listening to his program, which is pro-democratic. That's ridiculous. The guy is a shill. He's pro, you know, he's telling people get out there and vote. And, you know, he'll, when someone like, all right, don't get mad at me now. When someone like Alex Jones puts something out there that I, come on now, I understand. When someone like that puts out there something like, okay, FEMA camps are true, and, you know, someone like the media begins, the false media begins to shake and quiver and say, okay, we need to talk about this because we're not relevant. And they need to be relevant. And that's why you're finding different tiers of truth, including RT. But as long as that RT is out there, it is good enough to get someone off of RT. By no means would I ever put someone in front of RT and say, okay, good night, take care.
I see, that's a good point, exactly. Well, see, you know, that's what it comes down to. That's why, you know, I've always said that people need to read as many differing points of view as possible, even up to and including Jewish newspapers and Jewish-controlled newspapers like the New York Times and the Washington Post and all the others, to get as many differing points of view. Jim, I think you would agree with that.
You need to read everything and find out what's going on, except you need to cut Wolf Blitzer off. he's done enough talking for Israel. So if we can cut him off with RT, at least some of our people won't be completely brainwashed. So I would thank God for that, let me tell you.
All right, listen, Darren, appreciate your call. Very insightful, and hope you'll call in again. We are going through the break now. We have one more caller we can squeeze in after the break, and that's Chris calling from Las Vegas. I wonder if Chris is getting any money from Sheldon Adelson. Stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen.
Mike. Okay.
All right, we are wrapping up a very interesting 2 hours with Dr. James K. Warner. We have one more caller we're going to squeeze in here. That's Chris calling from Las Vegas. Chris, go ahead.
Well, good evening, Mr. Michael Collins, Piper, and especially your preeminent guest, Mr. Warner.
All right, thank you.
I really want to tell you that what you're speaking to is so right on the money. This RTTV is a testimony to the disparaging nature of the journalage, or lack thereof, in America, and the lamestream media is making itself totally irrelevant by producing nothing but propaganda, and we're having to go to Russia to get some true news.
You know, I'm laughing, but you're absolutely right.
Well, it's truly insidious, but whenever they have to go out of the country to be able to produce an element of truth because of the propagation of propaganda in lieu of it, it is really a truly, it should be a waking of experience for Americans. And I must say, Dr. Warner, that your associations with Eustace Mullins, I am so envious of. I've read much of Mullins' work, his Secrets of the Federal Reserve,
right.
Rape of Justice, Murder by Injection. There's another one on the Jewish faith. It's very expositive, and learned so much from the consummate investigator and fact checker who worked for the Congressional Library and the only individual to ever be fired from that position.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, yeah, Eustace has a published record there in his books. I hope Jim Warner would maybe someday be able to put together a compilation of all the stuff that Eustace wrote for his newspaper. I think that would be a book that a lot of people would want to read. Well, Chris, I want to thank you for your call. I want to wrap it up here these last final moments and express my thanks to Jim Warner for coming aboard. It's been a lot of fun, Jim. I wish we'd have done this a long time ago, and I know our audience enjoyed hearing you reminisce about some very interesting people and events in your own life and in others. So I will just say thanks again, Jim, and say keep up the good work.
And thanks for having me on. I appreciate it very much.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting, and as I say, there's a lot of lessons here to be learned for people who don't take this whole business seriously. This is not entertainment, folks. This is deadly serious. We heard here tonight from Jim Warner just two experiences from his life. One occasion, he had a bookstore raided by Jewish provocateurs, and it was Jim Warner that spent 6 months in jail for defending his property. And then in New Orleans, the biggest newspaper of the city, published by one of the most respected Jewish families in America, published attacks on him 5 days in a row, published his address, pictured his house right there in the paper. How would you like that to happen to you? That's the real world, folks, and you heard a slice of it here this evening. Thanks for listening in. Thanks to Jim Warner. Thanks to RBN for making this program possible. You do listen, folks, because you can handle the truth. Yeah,
Mike?
Folks, I'm told by my producer that I have a minute here. That means that my clock is not working correctly. I will just reiterate what I said because it is so important. What we have heard here tonight, just one man's experiences, a guy who's been out there for a long, long time fighting for the truth.
Can I interrupt you 1 second?
Yeah, go ahead. Jim, you're still there. Go ahead.
I've got a special edition of my paper coming out in about a week and a half, A Brief History of the War Against Tsarist Russia. It's got almost 50 pictures in it. It's a whole history, and it's going to be one thing that I contradict Eustace on to a degree is J.P. Morgan. I've got documentations and material about him and his son attacking the Jews for attacking them. They were in a war with J.P. Morgan, and Mullins didn't know this, and I have the documentation.